Hi, good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning for MIT's 2Q and first half financial year 2022-2023 financial results. We had uploaded our announcements together with presentation deck last evening. This morning we have management seated in the office to do a virtual presentation of the results. We have Guo Wei, our CEO, Lily, our CFO, Serene, our Head of Asset Management, Peter, the Head of Investments, and Kim, the Head of Marketing, myself, Melissa, and William from the IR team. Without further ado, I'll pass on the mic to Guo Wei, who will give a short intro to the financial results.
You mean I've been.
Oops, sorry.
Can you all hear me? Probably I've been spouting nonsense and got cut off by the police woman. Anyway, I said I was standing up, the rest are sitting down. Yeah, thanks for joining us. I'll run through the five usual segments that we present at our results release. First, I would go through the key highlights. That's the first segment. Who's controlling the. Okay. Now, if you look at the slide number five, you can see the operating performance continues to be fairly robust. You know, despite margins being squeezed by inflation effects and also higher utility costs. The distributable income actually had been fairly stable, 89 million dollars on a year-on-year basis for that quarter, 0.7% increase. DPU, you can see that effect coming down. This is of course partly due to the dilution effect from the series of distribution reinvestment plan we have in place. I think going forward, we continue to see more pressure coming from borrowing costs, so-called increases. Now, looking at the second set of bullet points, if we look at our portfolio performance, especially for the Singapore portfolio, has been very encouraging. Our occupancy level on an aggregate basis has gone up 0.3% to 95.6%, which is, if I could say, highest ever we have recorded for the Singapore portfolio ever since we listed the platform. The market, I think, continues to be helpful in the occupancy front. Even on the rates, as you would have seen in the details we have outlined, we have seen an increase in average rental rate as well, 213-215. Rent revisions are also a positive across most of our property types. In fact, the effective aggregate increase is positive 2.6%, which is a fourth consecutive quarter of increase. That is also another welcomed sign. That said, we have seen a small dip in the occupancy level for the North American portfolio because we have an asset fairly small, 0.4% of the portfolio revenue as of last year on a relative basis at The Leonia. We have a tenant that's moving out, so now we are of course in a process of engaging interested parties to take up the space. On the capital management front, the third set of bullet points, we are happy to report that the hedge borrowings we have managed to shift that up a little, 74.2%, almost 2 percentage points from 72.3% in the previous quarter, and the weighted average 4 years. That gives us a bit of a protection, but not full protection against, you know, the onslaught of the interest rate upward adjustments. And the DRP continues to be a good source of funding for us, especially when we still have our ongoing development project at Kolom Ayer 2. So last quarter, $40.2 million received, a very good take-up rate of 42.9%. Of course, as you would know, that is contributed mainly by the participation of MapleTree Investments as our sponsor. It's about 25% of that 42.9%. And the last bullet point, as a kind of a measure against the increasing so-called pressures we anticipate in the next couple of quarters from costs, so-called increases, and also borrowing costs upshifts, we will plan for the release of the $6.6 million that we had withheld earlier over the next three quarters. So that will help cushion some of the negative impact that we anticipate. So I think that rounds up the key highlights. But if you look at the chart that we have outlined on slide 6, the DPU profile is what you can see. We have outlined a dip to 3.36 cents for the current quarter. And we, of course, will work hard in keeping our occupancy levels healthy and then try to retain our tenants as far as possible while keeping a close eye on our margins and costs going forward. Okay, so I think that is a quick snapshot of what we have. The rest, I think, are fairly standard kind of components of what we normally update. We don't have anything really exceptional to highlight. I think there will probably be some burning questions some of you might have, so we can take them.
Thank you, Goh Wei. Just some housekeeping rules. Can we request for our analysts to keep your questions to two for each round? So, of course, if there are no more questions, you're very welcome to ask some more. If you can raise your hands via the WebEx platform, you can also contact us or via the live webcast. So we will take three questions on the various platforms. Can we have the first question, please? Jarek from DBS, please go ahead.
Hi, morning. Hi, thanks, Melissa. Hi, Guowei, good morning. I'll just ask one question. Essentially, it's on your refinancing, right? So could you give us more color? I noted there's some expiry next year, and looking where base rates are in the U.S., you know, it appears that things could spike up quite significantly. So maybe could you just share where you expect interest rates to land, and, you know, this $350 million, how should we think about your interest rates? Yeah.
Okay, the color we have is orange.
Okay.
I'm just trying to pull a fast one on you. Yeah, so the fella that... yeah. So Lily would shed some light on that, but I assure you it's still orange.
Okay. I'm wearing green today, hoping to get some positive vibes. But anyway, let's address the refinancing for this current financial year. If you look at the presentation slide on 13, we do have about $350 million of debt that is maturing in January. Okay. The good thing about this refinancing is in terms of the benchmark rate, we have already done the hedges for it. We have extended. If you recall, last quarter, I did mention that we have no repricing risk with respect to the interest rate swap because we have already extended the interest rate swap that is expiring in January. So that part is kind of lock up, right? We are currently negotiating with the banks with respect of the loan renewal itself. I think because it's still in negotiation, I'm afraid I can't say too much in terms of the pricing, etc. Okay. But I think we are hopeful and we are trying our best to keep the incremental cost to as low as possible. We don't think it's going to be very significant looking at what we have locked in ahead of time. I think for all intents and purposes, I think the risk that we are really facing here is the rate hikes that the U.S. Fed has been putting on, and that basically impacts the benchmark rates. I think in terms of the margin, the risk is not as high as compared to where the market interest rate would go. Okay, so I think for this refinancing that is coming due in January, because we have already done our extension of interest rate swap, that risk is very much mitigated, right? The next year, you will find that we have about 175 million of MTN's paper that is falling off. And this typically, you are looking at them somewhere maturing in middle of the financial year and end of the financial year. Okay, so I think that still gives us some breathing space. But nonetheless, the team will continue to look at how we can address the refinancing risk here. Okay.
Yeah, Lily, just to summarize what you mentioned, right? So we should expect that the increase in interest rates for this particular tranche should be much lesser than the base rates that we see increasing. Is that the right assumption? Because you already hedged it, essentially. You put in the hedges.
Yes.
Okay. Sounds excellent. I see a long queue. That's all from me. All right. Thank you.
David, can you please ask? Go ahead with your question. David from Daiwa.
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. I have a question on the accounting treatment of your hedges, because you're seeing a pretty significant gain this financial year. And how should I interpret this? Is this just accounting? It actually increases your NAV, so. Is there any way you can monetize this to offset the rising interest rates, or should these hedges just unwind on maturity and we should not even look at your gains on those derivatives?
Okay, for the derivatives, under the accounting standard, we are expected to do a mark to market. So of course, the IRSs that was taken on a few years back definitely is in the money now if you look at the interest rate environment, and that is also the reason why the derivatives value has actually increased. Whether do we want to monetize it? We can, but then the question is, the moment you monetize, you lose your protection going forward. So I think that is why I think typically corporate don't really actively look at unwinding their hedges. I think the hedges are there for a reason, for your protection. So question then is, do you just want to remove that protection just for that, just to monetize it, right? So I think the other point I'd like to highlight is also that such mark-to-market has no DPU impact whatsoever, okay? I think you will get the benefits when you do your realization, and you are right, you will unwind, you basically then unwind at point of maturity. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's pretty clear. Thank you. That's all from me.
Thanks, David. Mervin?
Hi, guys. Yeah, this question, in terms of the non-renewal in the U.S., just trying to understand the reason for a tenant moving out, and also you see other non-renewal risks outside AT&T over the next 12, 18 months. Thanks.
Okay, for this tenant, I think the activity level has been fairly low in the premise, so it's not a key location for its operations, so it decided to move out. And anyway, it's not a very large asset. As to other renewal, so-called discussions, I think the more prominent still remains the group of three AT&T assets. We don't have any other very large one in the coming, say, 12 months or so.
Do you have any of these smaller ones that could come out?
Smaller ones, I think we have a large, hyperscale user at the Northern Virginia asset. But on a relative basis, it's a smaller part of our portfolio that's having the lease up for renewal beginning of 2023. So that one, I think, is in the joint venture vehicle we have with Mapletree Investments and also with Digital. So Digital is funding that engagement with the tenant now. So we do not know at the present moment on the renewal kind of intention, but we are hopeful, and hopefully by November or December we will get some clarity on that.
Okay, thanks. I'll join to the back of the queue.
Tan Qian, you have a question?
Yeah, hi, morning. Just one question on the debt currency profile. The proportion of U.S. borrowing seems significantly higher as compared to your asset base. So is this a deliberate policy, and with refinancing, will you look to bring that down?
Okay, I think typically when it comes to the debt currency profile, the reason for the higher percentage in terms of U.S. dollars is more because we also try to ensure that there is a natural hedge with respect to the capital value, right? So, and of course, plus the fact that for the U.S. dollars borrowings that are taken onshore in U.S. itself, we actually are able to enjoy the tax deductibility when it comes to, you know, us having to pay the tax, etc. So there is certain benefits in us having a higher percentage of the U.S. borrowings. But having said that, I think in terms of the impact, the U.S. borrowings, we have a large part of our, our hedge ratio, okay, is about 74%, right? And that also means that the U.S. borrowings is quite largely hedged. So I think we only have about 25% thereabout of the U.S. debt that is not that is unhedged and therefore facing the risk in terms of the higher interest rates. So I guess
right.
You can say yes, that composition is deliberate because we were looking at the natural hedge as well as taking advantage of the onshore tax deductibility of the interest expense.
Okay, so with the refinancing this and next year, we shouldn't expect this ratio to change, right?
I don't think so. Yeah.
Fairly unlikely,
okay.
Unless you are able to get a lot more, say, exposure or kind of projects in non-US geographies, and you see that ratio adjusting. Because if you look at the nature of our so-called the fundraising exercises, it's almost entirely in Singapore dollars for equity. So whatever equity that we raise would normally be used to pay down existing Singapore debts. That's a lot more direct and so-called less cumbersome to execute. I don't think we're going to try to be inventive and take the Singapore dollar equity funds, convert it into U.S. dollars and pay down our U.S. dollars debt for the time being, because we still have a fairly decent level of tax shield by having a slightly elevated, which is a level of 60% when we first started, you know, of debt for the U.S. portfolio. So as with most instruments, there's no one instrument that is going to be suitable for all seasons. So that the profile that we have had been helpful, very helpful over the last 5 years. But of course, the trade-off is that you see more exposure, more direct exposure to U.S. Rate hike cycles. So that's what we are seeing now. That said, it's certainly helpful that we have a big part that's already hedged away. Then the small balance of about a quarter would be still having to experience the current volatilities.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tan Chen. Brendan, do you have a question? Brendan from Citi. Okay. Maybe Nicholas can ask your question first. Nicholas from Credit Suisse.
Yep. Yeah, can I just ask on some of the leasing progress? Just want to understand on the AT&T, although it's still early, you know, any color on like the backfilling or inquiries that you're getting on the spaces, and also the leasing up for Column IA too?
For the AT&T facilities, as of now, we don't have any additional updates that we can share. So we are still checking with the market and getting the brokers on board. It's about a year from now when the leases expire. So we would certainly update the community, you know, when we get some so-called interest from prospects. So at the present moment, nothing yet. For the Column IA 2, the redevelopment, we are discussing with a prospect for two floors in the middle block, block 163. So we, of course, have not sealed up the lease document yet. So we are optimistic, but you know, still working at it. At the same time, I think we are reaching out to a couple of interested entities, but not as close as this tenant who is taking up two floors. That two floors is roughly 27% of the NLA of that building. So if you split it up, you add another 8-10% to the occupancy level. So you would have crossed 30% if we include the first block of 24.4%.
Okay, and just one quick follow-up. In terms of the timing for the anchor tenant's lease, when does that start? Or when do they start paying?
Okay, effectively for us, after the rent-free, you'll be end March or early April 2023. So for ease of I think, modeling, 1st of April 2023 would be, a good date to pin the start date. After expiration of the rent-free period.
Understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicholas. I think Brendan has been trying to ask a question. Brendan, are you able to speak?
Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, can. We can hear you.
Yeah, thanks. Fantastic. Yeah, hey, thanks. Just two questions, right? The first one is with regards to the 6.6 million that you are returning. How should we be reading it? I mean, because they're going to distribute it over three quarters, why not four quarters, one of five quarters? Is it because you think that the next three quarters is going to be quite bad, or you're trying to engineer a DPU growth for the full year? Yeah, that's my first one. The second question would be, can you explain the year-on-year fall in NPI margin across several of your segments this quarter, especially on the US DC as well as the high-tech space XDC? Yeah, thanks.
Okay, the mathematics behind this is extremely complex. It's like us, you know, designing for a trip to Mars. So, but anyway, that was, of course, said in jest. Is not a precise kind of or exact science that we have. We think the release of the 6.6 million is timely, partly, of course, because of the increasing pressures that we anticipate in the next couple of quarters. But I think more specifically, should we do it two quarters or three quarters? There's no exact science to it. Our sense is that if you split it up over too many quarters, you'll be inconsequential and you'll be too dilute in terms of the effect. And we also do not want a concentrated kind of a release, say, in one quarter, which I think may not be helpful, you know, over the at least the next couple of quarters, because we see that continued pressure from at least inflation and then borrowing costs that will continue to feature for some time. So Of course, the debate is 2 quarters, 3 quarters. At the end of the day, we decided to spread it out a little more to 3 quarters. That would at least, you know, help us tide through that the next couple of months of greater uncertainty. And if you divide 6.6 by 3, 2.2 is a reasonably helpful quantum that we think would at least give some material help, you know, in terms of the profiling.
I think the questions on NPI margins, I think for the Singapore and the U.S., the reasons are quite different. For the Singapore portfolio, I think, as you all know, utilities expenses have hit across the board, especially for the high-tech, for the air-conditioned buildings, including high-tech. And we see this hitting the margins directly. For the U.S., if you notice, Q-on-Q, actually the NPI is the same. For the U.S., the treatment is a bit different because for whatever expenses we incur for the property, there is a claim back. So you'll see that gross revenue may be higher in some quarters if there are works that are to be claimed from the tenant. So I think for the North America data centers, the effect is largely mathematical and not so much because of any increase in property operating expenses.
Right, got it. Hey, thanks so much. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Brendan. I think we have Izayan on the... Izayan from OCBC. Would you like to ask your question, please?
Sure, thank you. So I have two questions. So the first one is, I think there's still a right of first refusal on a data center portfolio that is held at the sponsor level. So just wanted to get a sense of what's your thoughts on acquiring this given the current funding environment. Then the second question is on data centers. Has MapleTree Industrials done some kind of valuation on the data centers on an alternative use basis, say if they no longer are used as data centers? Yeah, that's all. Thanks.
Okay. The first one, I think, on the right to acquire, it remains there, and we are, of course, keen. At the end of the day, is whether the parent MapleTree Investments is ready to divest and at what price. So I think for this asset type, the prices continue to remain fairly tight, or rather capitalization rates remain fairly tight. So unless you get a very huge friendship discount that is so-called out of line with the market, my sense is that, say, if you take an arm's length kind of value for the portfolio, it will not be easy for us to execute a transaction, to do an acquisition. So we would, of course, keep an eye on our cost of capital, you know, both on equity and debt part, to see, you know, whether there's a window for us to engage our parent a little more so-called on this possibility. My sense is that at least for the next 6 to 9 months, fairly low likelihood for us to explore this. Yeah, in view of the market situation. But it's something that we would continue to monitor, and with the you know, right conditions, and in the when the market, the window opens, we would you know, pursue that with our sponsor. Now, on the valuation of the data centers or alternative use, as of now, for most of the facilities, the highest and best use generally would be for the data center operations. Say for some of the locations where we have the assets that are in, say, business park type of precincts, that would be the next alternative use, the so-called next alternative better use. So the valuations will probably not differ too much from what we have, because most of our assets in this kind of locations are leased on a triple net basis and mainly a powered shell or just core and shell basis. So the general kind of rent levels and valuation would not differ too much from, you know, what we're getting for the data centers. Of course, for the fitted hyperscale facilities, that's very different. The assets are purpose-built, and, you know, the fit-out element is a lot higher. But for this group of assets we have, the leases are very long, and the tenants, I think, are relatively a lot more sticky compared to the other groups of tenants. So that part, I think, the risk, of course, is there after the at the expiration of the very long leases, but it will be something that we'll need to review many years down the line. And, of course, on a positive note, there are certain so-called upgrades that we see, like, for example, the San Diego asset where AT&T is presently at. It did a one-year extension, I think we have outlined earlier, to December 2024. So that part of San Diego is actually a very vibrant life sciences hub. So that represents an upgrade in the so-called use for that kind of premise. So it is another angle that we are exploring in terms of conversion. Say if we are not leasing out the space to a data center operator at the expiration of the lease.
Thank you. That's very detailed.
Hey, thank you. I think I'll ask a question from the chat, Derek from Morgan Stanley. The all-in debt cost of 2.9%, what would this be after refinancing the $351 million in loans due? That's the first question. The second question, the Kolam Ayer 2 redevelopment is completing in the second half of 2022, first half of 2023. Is management worried about leasing progress so far, as it's just been committed by the anchor tenant? Any further updates?
Okay. On the all-in debt, the 2.9, is what is reflective of what we see in the current quarter, right? As for the refinancing, I think just now I said that we are trying to make sure that the incremental is not as high. And with us locking in the hedges ahead of time, we actually managed to lock in at a rate that is comparatively attractive as compared to what we are looking at now. Okay, so I think even if it does increase for the refinancing, we are hopeful that the incremental will be less than 50 bits. I think that's something that we are trying to do and we hope to achieve. But as I said, unfortunately, I can't give you guys too much details on that because we're still negotiating. Hopefully, we have some good news later on, right? So as to how it will change the 2.9%, I think if you recognize that the 350 million is only about 12% of my total debt, I think the impact may not be that significant as well, if you're talking about the incremental. Okay, I hope that answers your question.
Okay, the next question on the leasing of Kolam Ayer. We are absolutely confident, you know, of the ability and reach of our leasing folks, and they are working very hard, and they have been assuring me, you know, that they would be able to convert the many of the prospects they are talking to. So if you look at the track record, you know, of their delivery, we remain very positive. So there will always be some challenges in the market, especially when, you know, the environment is so volatile. But we have a good product, we have a brand new facility, we have specifications that are relevant, you know, to the industries that we are targeting. So we are positive. So you may take a bit of time in terms of leasing up, in terms of getting the tenants in place. And as I've outlined earlier, the block in the middle, block 163, we have we are very close to signing about slightly more than a quarter of the space to a you know, good brand name tenant. So the momentum is there. We will continue to work on that. But practically, I think if the question is on the contributions, you know, when we see the revenue streams coming, I think you'll be towards the end of 2023 that we'll see the kind of revenue streams being recognized, because by the time, say, we complete the development by middle of 2023, even if you can get a tenant to commit, then you have a fit-out and a rent-free period. So invariably, most of the contributions will probably be back-ended towards the end of 2023 and early 2024.
But for the block that we have already committed, we expect that to come in from beginning of next financial year. So that's 1st April, right?
Yeah, 1st April. That I think the 24.4% is confirmed. You know, that part, I think, gives us that base load as far as revenue is concerned. But the rest, I think, while we work hard at getting commitments in place, but practically, as I mentioned, with the so-called commencement times being staggered, and you have your all the fit-out and rent-free arrangements, so the real cash flow will probably be towards end of 2023.
All right, thank you. Can we have Vijay's question, please?
Good morning, Kobe. I have two questions. My first question is on the service charges. I mean, there were some discussions about increasing service charges in the past to mitigate this inflationary pressures. Is this still something on discussion, and if such a thing would be implemented, would it be across all the leases in your portfolio? My second question is related to Forex impact. With regards to the strengthening of the USD, how did this impact your DPU for this quarter or for the past 9 months? And if you strip off the USD impact, what would it be? Or is it fully mitigated by the interest payment in US dollars also? That would be my question.
Okay, on the service charge part, I think we have articulated our intent to increase our service charge. We are happy to, you know, share with you. We have done that 1st July 2022. So for our air-conditioned facilities, essentially the business park buildings and the high-tech buildings, that increase roughly 10%, you know, because we are making adjustments to the second decimal point on the service charge cost. So 10% increase, and I wouldn't say it's very well received by the tenants. We get some complaints here and there, but they grudgingly accepted the increase, so that has helped us offset, you know, some of the margin pressures from utility cost increases. Just to share, you know, our current read on the cost upshifts. You might remember we have shared before our utility cost increase. We anticipated roughly $10 to $12 million for the year, and it is fairly in line, you know, based on what we are seeing so far on the actual costs, so-called taken in. So probably you will fall quite well within the $10 to $12 million dollars anticipated. So that utility cost, rather offset from the service charge increase, would be helpful. Our gauge in terms of the impact from this service charge adjustment is probably $1+ million. It's not going to be very significant, but it's helpful in mitigating the effect, and it's also a signaling shared kind of pain that we have in place, you know, with our community. We have not raised the service charge rate for our non-air conditioned buildings, in other words, the multi-user feather factories, because these are not large so-called consumers of utilities. The buildings are not air conditioned. The equipment that is so-called powered by electricity would be mainly the lifts for these premises. So that impact is not as material, and we have weighed the pros and cons of pushing ahead that additional kind of so-called revenue, or I wouldn't say revenue, additional so-called contributions on the service charge you can get from this bunch of folks will not be that much, and it's an extremely painful process dealing with the thousands of small little SMEs on this front. So we have decided not to, you know, have a blanket across the board service charge of so-called adjustments. Now on the exchange or the forex so-called impact, I think Lily can shed some color on that. Essentially, we have a big part of our borrowings that are already hedged, so we don't expect any so-called big movements down there from the forex impact. On the distributions, we also have the hedges in place for the cash flows that we are receiving, but with different levels of kind of hedges that have been layered on over time. So I think Lily can share some so-called details on this.
Okay. As Guowei says, we typically look at the U.S. Income stream coming in from the U.S., and we take into consideration the net after the after looking at the interest rate that is in U.S. dollars as well, right? So the exposure we're looking at is really net of all this. We basically hedge the net income stream by looking at FX forwards. So we do that on looking ahead 4 quarters. So every quarter we will actually add a little bit of FX hedge or FX forwards for the quarters coming in the next 4 quarters. So basically, I think the key idea here is we do average our exchange rate that will be applied on the distribution. So if you imagine this quarter's distribution is probably made up of a few forwards that has been locked in 4, 3, 2, 1 quarters ago. And of course, we left at about maybe 20% that is on a spot basis. So I think typically that is how we manage the FX exposure. So I think the key thing we have to remember that when we do all these FX hedges is to ensure certainty in terms of the distribution, not so much of we are trying to benefit from, we're trying to, you know, profit from it. Okay, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, got it. Thank you. If I may just clarify on the first part, just to clarify that the service charge has been implemented across all tenants, not just for new leases, and this is the margins which we can expect moving forward after increasing the service charge in coming quarters. Is my understanding right?
Yeah, the service charge increase has been applied to all air conditioned buildings, so the high-tech facilities and the business park buildings, but not to the non-air conditioned buildings, the feather factories, stack up ramp up facilities. We don't have that increase in place.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think we are running out a bit of time. I'm going to take questions from those who have not had a chance to ask on the WebEx. That would be Xavier, Michael, and Amanda. Xavier, could you ask your question, please?
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Boi. Just want to check your views because Microsoft just warned of a slowdown of spending. I want to know whether you foresee weaker demand as well as longer lease-up periods for your U.S. data centers. And by extension, should we also expect a slowdown? Does this slowdown in cloud spending to affect Singapore data center demand as well?
Okay, I think the tech companies relooking at their growth plans, That said, you know, they're still growing probably at a slower clip. They will be making adjustments on their needs in some markets for sure. You can read about them downsizing certain parts of their workforce. But I think the medium-term outlook and demand continues to be very encouraging. And for the lease up of the space we have in our portfolio in the U.S., certainly that would have some impact and on the level of interest. We would of course continue to monitor the market very closely and try to find the right match for our space. The Singapore data center space, I think I would characterize this as still a landlord's market because the vacancy is extremely low. Whatever power that is available, already would have takers. So despite, the shrinkage in some quarters for some of the tech companies, I believe, if you are able to offer new space, additional or rather adequate power allocation for any facility, you'll be able to find a taker very quickly, because Singapore is in a situation where your supply is really or new supply is really non-existent, partly because of policy decisions taken 3 years back. As you know, there's a moratorium in place, so it is partly an artificial kind of constraint from the supply side. So if you have any space available or power available, that will be taken up very quickly. But that is also a challenge we face from a read or from a developer's perspective. It's not so easy to get hold of new allocation, new approvals for such facilities. So while we are very positive about the kind of demand that we are seeing here, we might not be able to exploit, the opportunities very effectively as a REIT, as a developer, as a property company, compared to, say, data center operators or users.
Got it. Thanks for the detailed response. So if I were to summarize, I guess the near-term challenge, there'll be near-term challenges for your U.S. data centers, but the medium to long-term outlook is still good. And as for Singapore, I guess the, as you mentioned, it's still a landlord market. Question is just whether you'll be able to take advantage of it.
Yeah, that is right. Yeah, as you know, there's a CFA, a call for application by the agencies for the data centers as closing, I think, next month. Quite difficult for us to be competitive in this space. You'll be the operator kind of a game instead of a property company or REIT or developer game.
Got it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Xavier. Michael, do you have a question for us? Michael from UBS? We'll take the question from Amanda first, please. Amanda's here.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Just have two quick questions, one on rent and one on leasing demand. For the rental, are you seeing any pressures on asking rent for your new leases? As you see that your new leases for Business Park, Startup Factories and Rent Park buildings in the second quarter saw lower new signing rent. That's my first question.
Okay, this so-called the additional sense and read of the market, probably I asked Kim to give you. She's been dealing with all these prospects, on a very intensive basis.
Okay. Right. For the flatter factories, right, we are actually very tactical in our approach because now our occupancy for the flatter factories has gone up. So some of the leases, the new leases, we were actually trying to get some very good tenants in terms of the profile. So that's why we have made some adjustment. But where there is a smaller spaces, we actually push up the rent. So on average, it does seems that it has a lower, yeah. But it helps us in the longer term. So for the stack up ramp up, it was due to largely a few big tenants that we were trying to replace. So we tried to get them to come in earlier. So that will help us to reduce the downtime. So it's more of a tactical kind of move. But on the whole, we are actually pushing the rentals.
I see.
So essentially, sorry?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. We just want to say Kim is getting more selective, partly because I think the so-called situation is a little more helpful now. The supply and demand situation is more helpful for landlords, but we are fully cognizant of the fact that there will be a lot of stock that will be completing end of this year, early next year. So it's always at a state where we are looking at the tension, whether you know we should nudge the occupancy up a little, whether we get better quality tenants to improve the profile of the precincts that we are managing, and also taking a more defensive position in view of the new stock that is coming to the market that will be competing with us. So this is striking that kind of balance, which Kim is working hard at, and exhibited in some of the figures that you see in our update.
I see. Okay. Thanks. Then on leasing demand, what is your read on the demand on the ground currently? Are you seeing any slowdown, say, from any particular tenant sector, sectors in manufacturing data, or maybe any tenant sector that's coming in strong?
I don't think we have so-called registered any material so-called shift in the level of demand, whether upwards or downwards. I think COVID, the so-called the issues are firmly behind us now. You know, everybody is walking around maskless, except for a few very careful people. So our tenants, I think, and prospects are generally, I would describe as positive. So I don't think there's any drop-off in demand. It continues to be encouraging, though, of course, you might have read in the recent reports there are certain segments that they're seeing some so-called reduction in say, industrial production or capacity, semicon industries being so-called under a bit of stress. But generally, we don't see any big negative issues across the different segments.
Thanks, Goy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Amanda. I think I'll just check if Michael would still like to ask his question. If not, Michael? Okay, I think we might have lost Michael. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us for this rather long call this morning. We hope we have answered most, if not all, of your questions.
There's one I managed to see, DRP, right?
DRP.
I saw it flashed up on the screen for 3 seconds. It went off.
Okay. So Derek's question has caught Goy's eye.
Everything would catch my eye.
Okay.
Blinking.
He would like to answer this question. Goy, we mentioned the merits of continuing the DRP, but wouldn't this be an expensive source of funding? Cost given trading yields, maybe more so than borrowings. We also saw the dilutive impact of the DRP this quarter.
Yeah. So it's not an easy kind of calibration to do. I agree, absolutely. It is costly relative to, say, our position a year back. You know, at that time, our unit price or equity cost is a lot more attractive from a fundraising perspective. But it is still at the current level at a premium over NAV. So if you look at it very theoretically, it is still beneficial to raise equity at a premium to NAV. But of course, on a relative basis, a little less interesting. From our perspective, we still have funding needs for our development project. And I think just as a quick reference, we have about a third more to go in terms of payments, not precise numbers. So that would require so-called us to get capital, whether debt or equity. So if we see continued support, you know, from our unit holders and also from our sponsor, we think it's helpful for us to continue for a little while longer to have the capital in place to cater to, you know, the funding needs for our development project until, you know, we finish up most of it. Certainly we can take debt, and our leverage ratio is still at a fairly healthy level, but it is not at a very low kind of a level where we have an extremely large headroom. We are still at the 37.8% level. So I won't describe this as an extremely safe kind of leverage level. Extremely safe is below 30%. We have reached then, that level some years back, and also partly because of our application of the DRP then as well over the quarters. And when we got to the very, very safe level, we turned that off. So we are certainly not near there, and with our current leverage level, it's good to keep a little bit of headroom and have some dry powder in place. But we are cognizant of the fact that it is on a relative basis less attractive means compared to a year back, and also the dilution effect to the portfolio. So we are recalibrating that, and we look at that in a quarter or two to see whether we will want to continue with the DRP program or not. But I think as of now, as we have outlined in the current quarter's release, we're continuing with this quarter first because we still have current needs.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for your time. Please reach out to us if you have further questions. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, thank you, everybody.